Bat Segundo here, and I wish to express my serious misgivings about Samantha Hunt's new book. As a somewhat older gentleman who's yet to have a chamberman walk through his door, I am wondering just how Tesla managed to do this. He was less outgoing and a lot older than I, and I have a feeling I could drink his sorry scientific posterior under the table. Yet he was still able to persuade an attractive young lady to be his companion. I realize the Motel 6 isn't the Hotel New Yorker, but really, is it too much to ask for one chambermaid to walk into my life?
Okay, so I am here with Samantha Hunt, who is the author most recently of The Invention of Something Else. How are you doing, Samantha?
Hi, it's The Invention of Everything Else.
I'm sorry. I've done a lot of interviews lately. The Invention of Everything Else. But it could be something else, too.
It could be something else, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Are you doing that? How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine.
First off, maybe we should start with an obvious question and go into more obscure ones later, but I wanted to first of all ask you about the first-person voice. Actually, there's three voices in this. You have the first person of Tesla, you have the third person of this alternate Louisa narrative, and then, of course, there's this mysterious colloquy that exists and comes not even, it's not even in, within chapters, and it's revealed later on. And I wanted to ask, it's almost, I suppose, to some, you could be second person, who knows, but I wanted to ask you why you needed multiple perspectives to tell this particular story. There's something about the actual Louisa narrative that's very interesting, because here you are writing something historically, and I'm not throwing a whole bunch of questions at you, so don't mind,
Yeah.
In which you kind of have to work within limitations, and I'm wondering if these limitations of writing in 1943 helped you to sort of deal with writing in this particular narrative. I mean, we could talk, maybe start from there, and I'll throw some more things at you. So
yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself a historical fiction writer at all, and so it was, you know, one of the most fantastic constraints to kind of impose this 1943 boundary on everything. The question about the two different or three different voices, I think it was because at first I felt so far removed from Nikola Tesla, and in some way, because he is a real man, it seemed inappropriate for me to be putting words in his mouth, and I was very uncomfortable with that. And so while I started writing him a little bit first person, sometimes third person, it felt very wrong, and almost like I was intruding on his memory somehow, and I didn't want to do that. So I made up the character Louisa to take some of the weight off. Yeah. And she was obviously a lot closer to me. It turned out that that's not the case. I mean, in the end, I felt very close to the character of Tesla that I created. And so I wanted to have them almost war. I mean, they're not warring with each other, but their chapters do alternate. Because that was what was going on in my head at the same time, too. Like, how could I, a young woman, interpret this man who's been dead for, you know, 70 years and was a famous scientist, whereas I am a lowly writer?
Yeah, well.
And so there was this opposition going on in my own head.
You have notes, very helpful notes, at the back of the book that I kept flipping to say, is this real? And then there's some things you put in there that I wasn't quite sure. Like, for example, how he has a hotel room, which is 3327, and 18 towels delivered to him. He insists on everything divisible by three. And yet that particular fact was not noted in the notes. And so I'm wondering how much invention was in fact going on throughout all this.
The stuff with Tesla, I really tried to stick to all the truth. I mean, I wanted you to be able to read the book and you can go away and have a working knowledge of the man's life. And so I did not make up almost anything about him. I really felt like this poor man, he's been so badly maligned already that I didn't want to create anything, bless you, anything too fantastic about him. And so, and plus, I really didn't have to, because the details of this fella's life are already so unbelievable that they read as fiction.
Yeah.
So he had this obsessive compulsive disorder with the number three. He'd always lived in hotel rooms, you know, 3327 he lived in, room 207 he lived in Colorado. I mean, he always had that. In fact, I found that I actually had to cut out parts that were true about his life, because they read as fictional in a way that I thought, oh, if, you know, somebody reading this book will come across that and think, this is really gimmicky, poorly written fiction, because he had things like, when he got off the boat to America, he took about 10 steps and he saw a man who was working on an engine that was broken. He had no money when he got to America. And the guy, he fixed the engine for him. This is in 1884, and the guy hands him a $20 bill. And this actually happens, he tells us. But I couldn't include that because I thought anybody would read that and think, oh, come on. You know, the streets of America are paved with gold. Don't give me this, you know.
Well, he said this, and that's the other question of whether we can actually believe him.
Sure. And he also wrote his autobiography later in life when, you know, the light of reason was perhaps growing a bit dim. And so he might have been fictionalizing his own. Yeah. I mean, he also said he knew when his mother was dying and he ran to her bedside and was there with her. He was highly sensitive. But things like that I felt like I couldn't even include because they read so much as fiction.
In terms of his autobiography, there is a text in this book that may be authored by him or may be authored by somebody else, which I also should note the... when I first saw the name Sam, I thought to myself, oh, this is metafiction, and then you sort of pull the rug out on that. And I'm wondering if that was one of the appeals of Sam Clemens, the fact that you shared his first name.
It's funny. I mean, that came totally by accident afterwards. I had... Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla were really good friends, and so... There was a scene that I had read about, a real scene, where Tesla sent Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain a package, but this is in, you know, like 1942, and it was $200, and he insisted the bellhop go deliver it to Mark Twain. Well, of course, Mark Twain had been dead for over 20 years by then, and that anecdote stayed with me, and I thought, oh my God, so he's alone in the Hotel New Yorker at the end of his life, and he's just talking to all these ghosts and even sending them packages. And that was so striking to me that kind of helped create this whole idea that there was this person that Tesla was talking to in his room at the end, and it's Mark Twain because he was his good friend. When I put it together that, of course, that he's telling this story to a man named Sam, I loved it because I am Sam. And... I mean, I just put that in there as a joke, kind of, that he's speaking to Sam the whole time.
Well, for the third-person narrative, I have to ask you about using New York locations. One is constantly aware of the topography in this from Luisa's standpoint. And there's also, you know, the goat is head.
Yeah.
I really liked that idea because I've myself, moving to New York recently, I'm obsessed with the statues that are throughout New York that no one pays attention to. So that seemed rather an apt kind of symbol. So I wanted to ask you about that. But I also wanted to ask you if landmarks along these lines kind of helped you to place Luisa, that you needed this. It's almost as if you needed to resort to facts to keep the narrative going. And in Luisa's case, you almost needed the kind of locative idea of facts here to kind of keep the narrative trajectory going. So maybe you can talk a little bit about this phenomenon.
It was so wonderful to be writing a book in New York City because this city is so unbelievably archived, and it's also a place where you feel, I mean, you can stand on any street corner and feel like, oh, wow, who stood here before me? In fact, right where we're sitting across the street, that's where Al Capone got married, that church. Oh. And I love thinking that, you know, you feel like, oh, Al Capone stood right where I stood right now. And that happens everywhere in New York City to me. And so it was wonderful to be able to walk through New York and imagine Tesla standing here or imagine Luisa standing here on this corner. At the same time I was writing this book, I was working on an essay about, I have these letters from my great-great-great-grandfather that he sent home from the Civil War. And so I was doing a lot of research about his time, you know, a little bit earlier than Tesla's time, in New York and walking through Hell's Kitchen where he lived and looking at the buildings and thinking, oh, okay, he lived here. And so I just kind of applied that same thing then to Luisa and to Tesla. I was lucky that the Hotel New Yorker is still in, you know, pretty great shape. It was closed for a long, long time, and that, in the same way that a lot of Brooklyn neighborhoods got preserved because they were so impoverished during the 70s, you know, they never got torn down and replaced with hideous 1960s and 70s architecture.
Yeah. Brutal, if you must ask me.
Yeah. I mean, look at the perfect example of that is right a kitty corner to the Hotel New Yorker is Madison Square Garden, where, of course, gorgeous Penn Station once stood, and then they tore it down to build that monstrosity.
Yeah.
And luckily, the Hotel New Yorker has you know, stayed there. It's been the same since 1930. There was the chief engineer who works there, Joe Kinney. He's more than an engineer. He's a kind of become the unofficial archivist of the hotel, and he saved everything. He had all the menus, they used to have an ice fangles, you know, where they have like skating girls come by your dinner table, and he had every single program from that, every single band that has ever played.
Wow.
And so
even the Protecto Array, did he actually?
The Protecto Array, I got because the Hotel New Yorker has actually, they had in their bathrooms at the time, they would keep glass cups, you know, to rinse your mouth out after brushing your teeth ostensibly, and it says on it, home of the Protecto Array, Hotel New Yorker, so that's going to like make you want to stay there. Because
I didn't believe you until I actually went on eBay and I found ads for the Protecto Array. It was really quite remarkable that here is this radioactive device that's intended to clean the room. In fact,
developed by General Electric.
That's true. That's very true. I wanted to sort of ask you about this notion of 1943 reflecting contemporary science. How much of this was dwelling on your mind? Did you actually, like, you know, for things like the Protecto Array, were you thinking in terms of a real pernicious technology that could be comparable to a pernicious technology that we look upon right now, and then maybe in 20 or 30 years would be considered to be, you know, pernicious?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like that happens all the time where, I mean, in both directions, where, you know, we'll be looking back at iPhones and thinking, haha, look how quaint this is. My goodness, can you imagine?
Or even the
that we thought this was a good idea.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Well, as soon as we're all dying of brain cancer from using our cell phones in 40 years or what have you. But I think it can also go the other way where, you know, where our children will be like, can you imagine they lived before we were able to teleport to each other's homes, you know, and... And so I had a lot of that going back and forth and thinking about, you know, the history of the future and the future of the history. And that was the joy in kind of in writing this book, was in transposing times like that onto one another. My time, 1943, turn of the last century.
Well, you have the old woman remarking upon what it was like to live before electricity. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I remember the time when we had before the internet, all this thing.
And in fact, that old woman is drawn directly from my grandma. She grew up in Brooklyn. And she said, I asked her, I said, you know, do you remember before electricity? And she said, sure. I didn't get electricity in my home until I was 4 years old. And she told me, she said, I said, well, you know, what'd you think of it? And she said, my sisters and I were lying in bed, and my father had brought home a new electric light. And it was overhead, and we were staring up at it. And she said, we just thought it was the most annoying, horrible thing, and we covered it over with a brown paper bag. So that woman in the book is drawn directly from my grandma.
Yeah, interesting. Well, in terms of pernicious technology, I mean, we introduce radio, and we see kind of a premonition of what radio is going to turn out to be with the Azor interview. Initially, we're introduced to Louisa listening to it rather benignly and enjoying the radio dramas and the like, how this is almost the kind of galvanizing point for her to meet up with Tesla, who is, of course, the guy who invented the radio and had it absconded with by Marconi.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of ask you about, again, these kinds of echoes of having a sort of in-between form of radio that's not quite corrupted, but well on its way to being corrupted into this terrible mass media sensationalism as journalism kind of approach.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably the most wonderful part of the research, was listening to all these old radio shows, because, my God, they're so full of wonder and so much innocence, and it's kind of, you know, at a time when radio was so sweet, and, you know, and all the newscasters are doing the ads themselves.
Yeah.
And I love
the
that.
The Mixed Nuts ad, too.
Yeah, the Mixed Nuts ad, exactly. And, I mean, there's still a little bit of radio like that, especially on the AM dial. You can kind of hear old-timey shows in that way, and I love that. I love that. And it is sad now to think that there's nobody even manning the stations, you know, that they're kind of on autopilot in some way.
Quite literally, actually, with clear channels reprogramming.
Yeah, and you know, that there's no local differences, of course, in broadcasting. And so that was really kind of wonderful for me to be researching all these old radio programs and feel like, you know, I had this great excuse to be listening to them.
I'm wondering if you wanted to portray the exuberance of a relatively new technology here.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, before it's going to be corrupted, and that this was really, I mean, this is one of the sort of ideas here. Is that,
I mean, and Louisa becomes that character where you can kind of, all technology is bouncing off of her as, you know, the everyday Joe. And she kind of is the character who experiences, oh, here's radio, and I love it, and look how wonderful it is, you know, or here's electricity, and I love it, too. And, I mean, there's a blackout in the hotel. And I was writing that, actually, around the same time that we had the blackout here all across New York City. And that it happened on August 14th, so of course it was sweltering hot, you know. It was a great, great night, though. I actually had more fun that night than I've had in New York in a long time. But But sure enough, you know, as the night wore on, I kept thinking, oh, I really love electricity, and I wish it would come back. And I think, you know, a lot of New Yorkers felt that way, that there was a profound new love of electricity after the blackout. And so I was hoping to kind of get Louisa into that state of mind where she was new to technology and seeing it all.
Well, I mean, this sense of wonder is both exciting. I mean, to me anyway, it was both an exciting sense I got to all this kind of technology and all the sort of, hey, we've got a time machine, never mind that it's crackpot science. It's the enthusiasm and the exuberance that really makes one interested in these characters. But simultaneously, there's also a sense of sadness I felt, a sense of sadness that is also there at the end, which I don't want to give it away, but we can kind of obliquely talk about it.
Yeah.
But the sense of sadness also in knowing that, well, this technology, it's going to be stifled by this commercialization. It's going to be just decimated by the inevitable march of absconding with people's technology. It's like you're presenting this kind of, in a certain way, kind of an alternative science history with this book. And I'm wondering, should novels be in the business of presenting this? Is really the kind of exuberance that we're talking about here better for a novel than it is, say, a nonfiction book, which can't quite, I mean, it has to be objective in some sense and therefore can't be judgmental? And also, as a kind of third or fourth question, how much did you concern yourself with judgment on the part of the reader in terms of making this kind of a Rorschach test?
Yeah, I not too much. I tried not to think about the reader much at all. But your question is a good one, because I did worry about, you know, where...
That's okay.
I have to hear your questions again.
Well, okay, no worries. I threw a bunch. Okay, so we're dealing
too many for
we're dealing with the sense of both joy and sadness.
Yeah.
In a technology being corrupted by commercialization.
Yeah.
We're also dealing with this nonfiction versus fiction question.
Tesla was, I mean, the part of the reason why I was drawn to him in the first place was because he really, to me, exemplifies the last of the great individual inventors. I mean, he did not have corporate affiliations. He didn't take much money from. Well, he would have liked to have more money from investors had he gotten it, been able to get it. But he wasn't affiliated with a university. He wasn't affiliated with a corporation. He wasn't affiliated with the Department of Defense. And I don't know how many inventors we have like that anymore. So for me, he becomes really the last inventor who considers himself an artist in some way. And in that way, I really responded to him. I felt like, oh, he's just, you know, basically going into his studio and making AC electricity the way somebody might make a painting. Yeah. And he really was this kind of fantastic artist inventor. Now, I'm not sure that exists at all anymore. There's probably people toiling in their garage, but they're not, because of how much money perhaps is required nowadays to get anything out in front of the public eye to launch a product, you know. I don't know that anybody could actually do that anymore.
They exist in geek clusters, but it's also interesting
How much are they catching on? I mean, I don't know.
True.
And so I never, ever wanted to write a biography of Tesla. First of all, there's many, many good ones out there already. But second of all, that wasn't my point, because I did want to address this issue of, you know, where are the men like Tesla, the women like Tesla nowadays? And I'm sure they are out there. It's true. But I don't know why they're not, you know.
They're not more prominent.
They're not, yeah.
But, I mean, maybe that's sort of a mass media versus internet media kind
sure.
of thing. I mean, I mean, go to Slashdot, you'll find tons of geeks. You go to Boing Boing, you'll find tons of, like, people toiling around in garages.
That's true. But I can't understand why we're so stupid that we're not using these people's ideas more.
Yeah.
I mean, why isn't that what is at the cutting edge of technology and what's being written about by the mass media?
Well, I'll throw two questions at you in pertaining to the book, and that is, one... You said that Tesla viewed himself as an artist, but as you depict him in this book, he's not necessarily an artist. He's convinced that he's essentially taking natural forces and essentially he has no authorship to them.
Uh-huh.
And that this ideology stands in sharp contrast to the kind of capitalistic corporatization of technology and the
absolutely.
Like. And there was another point I was going to raise in relation to this, but why don't you go ahead and...
Yeah, I mean, many of the technologies that he was working with, he thought were larger than he, and how could he possibly own them? You know, he can't own AC electricity. It kept him from protecting his patents, of course, which got him into financial trouble and maybe limited the rest of the inventions that he could have made further down the road. But there's also something so wonderful about that idea, about feeling that, oh, this is, I'm only channeling some sort of muse or something, and so I don't own it, and I'm just going to give the invention to the world.
Was there a torn of contract that you discovered between Westinghouse?
Oh, yeah, there absolutely was. Westinghouse said, you know, AC electricity is going to die. This is when J.P. Morgan's trying to buy up all of the electric companies in New York City, and Westinghouse says, you know, your technology is going to die if Morgan forces me to sell to him.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be able to get any investors if there's this contract exists with you, because it was for such a large amount of money. And he said, you know, our only choice is that's the end of AC, or you tear up your contract with me, which in, you know, turn of the century was worth $12 million.
Yeah.
And Tesla tore it up. He tore it up because he'd rather see AC get out there into the world than...
But this meeting between the two gentlemen, I mean, was this... Who recorded this? Where did you draw these facts from?
Because from Tesla's autobiography.
From Tesla. But again, we're dealing with possibly an unreliable narrator here,
so to speak. I mean, that's funny that you bring that up, because I started feeling like, oh, I mean, I must have read 20 different biographies of the man. And the one truth that I pulled away from it was everybody's going to have their own opinion about how this man lived his life. Because, you know, there was stories as vast, so wildly different. For example, one biography that I write about in the book, the one by Margaret Storm, it's printed in bright Kelly green ink, and she says in chapter 5, the Tesla chapter, Nikola Tesla was born on board a spaceship traveling from Venus to Mars. You know, I mean, so there's even biographies that claim he's a spaceman.
Yeah.
And so the versions of truth that I found out there were, you know, all across the spectrum.
There's something about Tesla's perspective that I find interesting, in the sense that him talking to pigeons and him talking to Martians is considered possibly more acceptable during that time period than we would accept someone today. We would call them a raving loon. And yet here he is, largely because a lot of these big money people are incapable of perceiving this. Like, he walks into this poverty party, and they think that he's actually dressed for that particular party.
This seemed
a very interesting sort of commentary upon your part on this idea of accepting the misfits. And I wanted to ask you about this, because it comes across also in the book, because you don't really feel that he's a loon. But yet, at the same time, near the end, you start to realize the full kind of mental debilitation that's going on. And I wanted to ask you about this notion of embracing the misfits and the misunderstood, as was designed in this novel.
Well, it's interesting, the talking to Martians, when he got back from Colorado and he said, you know, I think I've made contact with Mars. At that time, Lord Kelvin was over here in America, and Lord Kelvin met with Tesla, and he said, yes, of course it's possible to talk to the Martians.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks Lord Kelvin's a nut job, you know. I think it just also happened to conveniently be timed to when Tesla was, you know, saying, well, maybe I could distribute electricity for free. And I think the thing that people really thought crazy about him was that he didn't want to make money. He did want to make money. That wasn't the number one goal. And so this idea that, you know, that he was a nut job, or that he was really talking, you know, that talking to Martians was so far and way out, I'm not sure. I think that you're right, that it was more accepted at the time to be saying things like that. I mean, maybe because we were more innocent, we didn't know that there is no life on Mars right now.
Yeah.
And it's sad to think that that kind of sense of wonder has actually been killed by gaining more knowledge. I guess that's what knowledge does to wonder.
Yeah. Or cynicism. I mean, you know, accepting the Azor claim that he has his time machine when it's clear that everything he's saying is utter bullshit, malarkey, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, this to me is fascinating. And you base that off of a real-life radio interview in which there was a similar kind of scenario going on.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if with the new technology and the enthusiasm and the exuberance and the passion that comes with it, you have this increasing sense of believing what's going on, even though, you know, if you start to think about it even remotely, you'll start to ask questions.
And that's partly why, I mean, Louisa is a great character for this, because she's young enough and kind of innocent enough to still look at it as a child. I mean, I guess children are a good way of returning us to that state of, like, my niece, who's 4 years old, would certainly believe that a time machine could exist, you know, if I explained the idea to her, and maybe would even believe you could speak to people on Mars. And so Louisa's kind of innocence in this, or in fact, when I first made that character, she was I described her as being simple.
Yeah.
As in simple-minded. I don't think she came out that way finally, but I wanted her to be somehow simple enough to still have a strong relationship with Wonder.
Yeah.
But well, how sad is that?
No,
that
I know. Yeah. But the other thing that's interesting, and we haven't even touched upon this, is the asexuality of these characters.
Yeah.
Even Louisa,
mm-hmm.
to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if you can't embrace the innovation and the exuberance, you have to give up something. And that seemed to me a very interesting...
That you do have to be childlike in some way to...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
very sad.
And the fact that we have a childlike, you can't have both. Mm-hmm. I mean, was this kind of a way for you to present this idea of, okay, well, if you're going to accept a couple of things in life, you can only do X and Y, but you can't do Z as well. I mean, how did this come about? Did it come largely from your exploration into Tesla? And how did this kind of manifest itself in Louisa?
Yeah, I mean, the asexuality of Tesla certainly just came from his actual life, that he never had a partner, besides a pigeon who he was in love with, which is, of course, probably the most innocent relationship possible. And transferring across to Louisa, I mean, there is something wrong with all of these characters in some way that they, I don't know, that they are able to be childlike, that they are able to keep this wonder alive. And that's frightening in an adult, mostly. I mean, normally when we encounter childlike adults, they scare us. It's something that I guess I didn't even really consider too much in the writing.
But surely when you designed Louisa, you had to sort of be aware. I mean, it's very clear that with the exception of Arthur's advances, there are very, very few, sexual or romantic components to this kind of character.
Yeah.
So you made a particular decision, and I'm wondering if it came from Tesla. I mean, it had to have come from
somewhere. It came from Tesla, certainly. Yeah, that he's setting the tone for all of these people, you mean, in some... I guess it did come from him. I mean, yeah, that is kind of a sad comment that...
But you made the decision, because Louisa is entirely different from you. So, I mean, I must ask as to, why you needed her to be asexual or aromantic.
I think I found her somehow damaged by the fact that her mother's gone, and that seemed that how she would be to me. That seemed believable, that she would have a slightly cynical edge, too, towards romanticism. Her father is so steeped in romanticism for someone who's dead that in some ways she thought, what's this going to get me, this... And her dad is maybe not taking the best care of her because he's so stuck in the past when his wife was still alive.
Is this why you made her somewhat hermetic? Because she does tend to pretty much go to work and hang out with her father most of the time and in the subway, and that's really her only...
She doesn't get along in society so well.
Yeah.
No.
So she has this kind of model of her father who's longing for the long-dead wife. And but I mean, I don't know. I think she would be smart enough at this, even at this age, to kind of realize that this isn't the way that all relationships are.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm sorry to obsess over this.
No, it's okay. There is one section where she kind of explains too that she's had bad luck in the past and gone out with a kind of some losers. And so, I mean, maybe she's already past the point where she's already become cynical romantically. That. And I think that was encouraged certainly by her father's romanticism, that she's able to just kind of write it off.
Or even her mother, who had 8 men for 7 days, as you said. I mean, I'm just curious about the promiscuity of the mother in real. It's almost as if something, there was this disconnect across generations that I was curious about.
And certainly there is a disconnect. She never met her mother except in birth. Yeah. I mean, and also Louisa is a motherless child, which... I mean, there is something maybe going to not translate, a lack of tenderness or something that Louisa certainly has because of that, because of not having a mother.
I wanted to remark upon the government agents who appear near the end. I don't want to reveal it, but it reminded me very much of Philip K. Dick. And I also have to ask you, was science fiction an influence on this?
I haven't read a lot of science fiction, to tell you the truth. I mean, certainly... The idea of science fiction was always present in my mind in writing this, and I'm dealing with a time machine and a lot of things that are true to science fiction. But it's funny because I don't read a lot of historical fiction and I don't read a lot of science fiction, and then I've written this book that has quite a bit of both in it. I guess the government agents are kind of just the perfect manifestation of paranoia.
Yeah, I know, and that, Philip K. Dick pretty much. Mm-hmm. About it. Well, I mean, I'm also curious as to the time machine in this, which is there, but It's almost as if you were reluctant to fully embrace the time machine.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
curious
it's a broken time machine, right? Yeah. I couldn't make it actually work because, again, something about that felt so kind of gimmicky to me. Because I was dealing with a real-life man, I didn't want it to, you know, come across as this after-school special of like, come on, children, let's get aboard the time machine and go back and look at Nikola Tesla's life. Or, I never wanted to have a time machine that functioned fully.
I don't know, but that's more of a tonal thing. If you introduce a time machine into a book, it doesn't necessarily have to come across as a kind of hackneyed after-school special. So I'm wondering, also, this leads me to ask you about the sense of wonder that is that extends throughout the entirety of the book. How did you manage to keep that going? Because, I mean, that's quite a chore there, because you have to constantly keep everything exciting,
well,
and that's something every writer can do.
But one thing that you're not mentioning is that there's a lot of grief in the book too.
Yeah. Oh yes.
And I think that I was able to keep the wonder alive by marrying it to grief. Grief has always kind of been my specialty in writing. I don't know why. That's absurd.
You seem so happy about it. See?
No, I don't know why. But a lot of the, for example, with the time machine, I mean, I think I used that to speak about how, you know, how sad it is that there are no time machines in some ways, you know, that we keep on kind of hitting up against that same frustrating wall of not being able to go back in time and fix things. And so to have a broken time machine is even a greater grief to me than having no time machine at all.
But yet this grief is also rooted in the past, which is very interesting. Does grief in the past naturally bring forth exuberance? It's quite an interesting emotional situation you've got yourself into here.
I guess that's true. Grief in the past does bring forth exuberance, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, like,
not for everybody. I'm curious as to how this extends towards you and your fiction.
I mean, I think there's a lot of salvation in death, certainly, you know, and, you know,
woo-hoo!
Other people, no, not my death, certainly, but other people dying remind me that I'm alive, and that reminds me to feel wonder.
That's quite morbid.
I'm sorry, that is the truth. After my own father died, I really felt like, boy, I better jump into life, you know, and certainly, I think that's how Louisa has a little bit of that at the end. That's what she realizes, you know, okay, all these people have been marked by death here, and I'm not going to.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Fair enough. I wanted to also ask you about Superman battling Tesla.
Yeah.
Was this just one of those? I mean, cultural references are here, but you have done a very good job of not making something of that time appear, you know, pronounced. I'm become a little bit more sensitive to cultural references for some reason in the last year in my reading, and so I was interested in this idea. Did you, if you were going to use a cultural reference in this, I mean, you could only use something that everybody would identify, perhaps like Superman, to make a broader point about how the culture existed at that particular time.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, in terms, or versus this, versus inventing programs like this Azor radio interview and the like.
Yeah. I mean, using the Superman, I think that that was one of those moments where I couldn't believe the research that this actually happened, that, you know, that Superman did fight an evil villain named Tesla, and how, while Tesla was still alive, and I thought, oh God, I can't resist such a heartbreaking detail. I have to include that. Yeah, I just couldn't resist that. I mean, it's so perfectly embodied the racism that might have been part of the reason Tesla's so poorly remembered in America, that, you know, even just that name scares us, you know. It has all these hard corners, Tesla, and it sounds scary. It sounds very un-American.
Yeah.
And so if Superman is the greatest American superhero battling Tesla, oh, that was a cultural reference I couldn't.
And of course, the two kids who came up with that, again, exploited by forces as well. You know?
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you about this being set in 1943, but simultaneously, it doesn't really feel as if it's 1943. It could almost be a decade before or a decade after, that you don't even get the sense of World War II in this until near the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask why you sort of didn't focus so much on the war.
On the war? I think the war wasn't my story. I had an entirely different ending to the book in the beginning that brought in the atomic bombs and that brought in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and because it played out so beautifully, thinking that Tesla was developing a death ray And he, you know, naively believed if we have an ultimate weapon, then there'll be no more war ever, you know.
Yeah.
And died just a few months before that was proven untrue. I mean, he died right in the beginning in 1943, and so he doesn't know that these bombs are going to go off. I couldn't quite make it work without that seeming too pedantic, and so I went easy on the fact that this is happening during World War II. It felt too... I think because we are at war right now, when the book is coming out, that it felt really too pedantic to keep on driving home the fact, you know, that war is bad, and maybe too simple to what I was trying to talk about in terms of invention also.
But it's also sort of perverse, because here you have these dangerous industrial forces,
yeah,
which were very much in place, in progress in 1943. And they're sort of declared evil by these various characters, yet at the same time they are at the forefront of culture at the time. I mean, in fact, rationing doesn't even exist, which I was a bit of a shock to me, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's why I sort of was kind of unnerved by this a little bit, so, you know.
No, there is rationing in the book. Yeah, Louisa can't get butter, remember?
Oh,
there's
that's
the one scene?
Right, yeah. That's right, okay.
So they are on rations, yeah.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you about the rivalry with Edison for AC power.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, Tesla himself says that he doesn't much care about, he's not jealous or he's not envious in any particular way, and I'm certain that probably came from Tesla, but I'm also wondering if this is a way for you to inure your own possible judgments, because surely if you're reading 20, 40 books on Tesla, you're probably going to be rooting for him in some sense against the evil sort of Edison.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering what you did to keep your own sort of subjective judgments at bay in relation to the Westinghouse Tesla-Edison contretemps.
I mean, it's tempting to not completely skewer them, of course, because they've been so, you know...
It's the easy thing to do.
Yeah, well, and they've been on a pedestal for so very, very long. And, you know, I was taught both of them in school, and I was never taught Tesla. But then, you know, ultimately, they had a lot of the same fever that Tesla had, and I admire that. And I think, you know, at the end, I tried to really come down sympathetically on Edison, because I do feel like after he was gone, I mean, there's a lot to miss there, too, even though he was really such a great marketer and maybe not such a great inventor and really stole a lot of people's ideas.
And worked inventors to death, too.
Yeah, and worked inventors to death, drove them crazy. I still miss his type around here, I feel like. And so I have Tesla missing him just a little bit at the end. I mean, and it's more just a sadness for a past time, I guess, you know, that at that, you know, during the 1880s, 1890s, oh, how exciting to be in New York and to be like, okay, let's wire the whole city for electricity or... And I don't know, I had a lot of nostalgia for that time, I think. And so even Edison...
So Edison,
at the end of the book, I had to kind of force myself to come to terms with him and to feel some sort of, you know, admiration and respect for him.
So Edison, it seems like there are two types you miss. One is the kind of independent inventor along the lines of Tesla, and the other is the kind of corporate, oh, we're going to go ahead and completely dominate.
You know what it is? It's kind of like how, you know... people hang up like old Coca-Cola ads in their house, and they're like, oh, look at those beautiful old Coca-Cola ads.
Which is disturbing on some level.
It's totally disturbing, and yet, it, you know, it evokes some sort of nostalgia. I guess that's how I feel about Edison. He's kind of like one of those old Coca-Cola ads.
It's a safer nostalgia then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about Robert Johnson and Katherine Johnson,
oh,
who we haven't even brought up.
Yeah.
This, I'll be going to the idea of dividing everything by three. Well, here Tesla is essentially triangulating his own social life through these two figures.
Yeah.
And why did these two strike more of a chord with you than many other sort of famed people? I mean, they even make more of an impact on Tesla's life than Sam Clements.
Yeah. They were very close with him, the Johnsons. And I also was always interested in them because Catherine, it is very well documented, was in love with Tesla. And yet her husband... was kind of also in love with Tesla. And I thought, God, this is, like, how wonderful that the three of them can sustain this relationship throughout their whole entire life. I mean, they really took care of each other even till the end, even after Catherine was already dead. And that you're right to mention this triangulation. I mean, I see this as kind of just the most beautiful relationship, that the three of them were able to maintain this triangle without ever collapsing it.
Yeah.
And you know, and in some way, possibly keeping desire alive or keeping Tesla's creative mind alive in, through that desire. And I mean, they were fascinating people themselves. He was the editor of Century Magazine for ages and ages and ages. And through her, there's a lot that I about her that I didn't include that I wish I'd had room to include, where she really was feeling the plight of women at the time and not being able to, you know, kind of be as out there as Tesla was or as her husband was intellectually or whatnot.
Or even exuberantly, I'd argue.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. And so Catherine was interesting to me in that realm. And it was through Catherine that Tesla made his famous statement about, you know, women, because of their minds having been in a rested state for so long, when they finally take power over from men, they're going to rule much better.
Yeah. There's one review I want to bring up at the Chicago Tribune of your book, which was very strange to me, because the reviewer confessed that she didn't understand certain descriptions of yours. Like, she complained about, oh, the city beginning to scream, or a face that has streams of volcanic lava. And she said that these off-kilter metaphors didn't work for her, but I think that, you know, I was reading this going, well, you're kind of missing the point of the book, because this book is very much about these kinds of metaphors and these kinds of ways of approaching typical everyday data in a completely unique and sort of associative way.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about how this manifested itself in the prose.
It's funny. Like, I think that with that review, I can't totally remember it, but I think that it almost seemed like as though the reviewer was expecting
some hardcore.
If this is going to be a biography, it'll be a biography. I mean, maybe she's a bit stiff in her way of thinking, but I mean, I wanted to write something that was historical, biographical somehow, and also using language that's beautiful. And I don't know why all three can't be possible at the same time. And that frustrates me that people want to keep this kind of writing in this classification or this kind of writing in this classification.
Yeah.
And you can't use beautiful language if you're writing about an actual historical figure. And I thought, come on, that's absurd.
What's interesting to me is that, I mean, I'll confess to you that if I read a sort of straight historical fiction, I think to myself, well, I may as well read a biography.
Exactly.
I may as well go, I mean, you know, and so I wanted to ask you about the idea of like a hard historical fiction versus a sort of kind of a shade of historical fiction where you have a mashup with, say, a character like Louisa and the like. I mean, is this just something that just you work better off of? And going back to what we were discussing at the very beginning of this conversation, the notion of taking facts and putting them into fiction, I'm wondering if there's, you feel that sometimes with too many facts, you almost have too much of a sense of order, that you can't fully embrace the wonderful anarchy of fiction.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had to stop doing research. At a certain point, I was like, okay, enough. Stop going to the library. You can't do any more research, because it was in some way killing the fiction of it. Or you know, it's easier to do research than it is to write fiction, I found. And so I had to kind of stop relying on that after a certain point. And it's true. I never, ever wanted to write a historical novel. I just wanted to write a novel that was about the life of Nikola Tesla. It's been interesting to see you know, how bookstores or reviewers are kind of mad to like, oh, wait, we've got to classify this. It's historical fiction. Or
was a novel ideas? Did you intend this as a novel of ideas? Or
I think that was the initial interest in Tesla, was that his life presented all these questions about our time now and, you know, where's technology going? Where's the inventor going? So certainly that was the inspiration.
Huh. I mean, I'm wondering, in terms of dealing with a novel of ideas, you run the risk sometimes of being almost too intellectual, so then you have this, but you have this visceral understreak. Was this kind of one of the motivating factors behind the Louisa narrative too? Or
I have to confess that ultimately the one thing that always gets me to write is just thinking about language. And so, novel of ideas, you know, historical fiction, science fiction, those aren't really things that I think about until afterwards. To tell you the honest truth, I mean, I really just write because I like to explore language, and Tesla just seemed like a great way to marry science. And it's funny that I'm often inspired by science because I don't understand it, and because it does seem like one place where mystery is still alive and where, you know, there's a lot of fuzziness in my mind that triggers fiction.
I'm wondering how much science you had to learn. Was there something about scientific terms that triggered this linguistic impulse in your head?
About not understanding?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I did. I tried to school myself a little bit, and a good friend of mine's an electrical engineer, and I would call him up at all hours and be like, wait, no, tell me. And certainly part of that was the joy in not understanding a lot of it. And, you know, even as much as he would explain it, I'd be like, what? Oh, but he would, you know, use a certain term, and I'd be like, don't tell me any more about that term. I don't actually want to know what it means, because...
Did you have other advisors? I've asked this of other authors in terms of some authors have told me they have, like, a great sort of crew of, like, the car guy or the you know, anything like that.
Well, Joe Kinney at the Hotel New Yorker was definitely the Hotel New Yorker guy. I mean, he... and he also happens to be an engineer, and so... Yeah. He helped me quite a bit with everything. I could call him up at any time.
The name Azor is interesting to me because it's evocative of A to Z. I wanted to ask you about that.
Oh, that's funny. It's actually a family name. It was a great, 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 great grandfather. Azor Ruggles Mills.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking like the guy just had an encyclopedic knowledge of some sort.
A to Z.
Well, in terms of, you know, the other names like Louisa, I mean, were you thinking like Louisa Ray or what was the deal with that?
Louisa has absolutely no reason for having her name. There's no story behind her name. I don't know.
Are there any stories behind any character names?
Walter is my own father.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the characters have names from friends or kind of people in my life.
Well, Walter's an interesting name because you don't encounter too many Walters, but that seems a name very evocative of that particular time as well.
Yeah, and it was funny because even when my dad was given the name in 1929, he always said he felt like an old man when he was 4 years old for having this name.
Gotcha. Oh, I also wanted to ask you about the 1893 World's Fair and the White City.
Yeah.
When I read this, I then was reminded instantly of like, oh man, I still haven't finished Against the Day. But also, I wanted to ask you if Devil in the White City or Against the Day were in your mind. Probably not Against the Day since it hadn't come out yet.
Yeah,
but,
I started Devil in the White City, and then that was during the time where I thought I have to stop doing research. And so I put it aside, and I never finished it.
Yeah.
A lot of the research to that was done just very quickly at the New York Public Library, like one read through an article that I found online about it, and that was it. And so, sometimes I found that I really had to stop doing research.
Really? Well, was there a sort of, how much research is too much for you?
A little is best, to tell you the truth. A little that has really clear, wonderful details, which, of course, any description of that fair would have, you know, where they tell you, oh, this exhibit was here, and Jane Austen's manuscripts were over here, and, you know, and the fair worked perfectly in that I could get a list of the exhibits that were there and allow them to just kind of create the scene for me. And plus, I could see a photo of it, which was helpful. I did read, Chris Ware has a great, one of the Jimmy Corrigan is set in... 1893 at the World's Fair, and he's got beautiful scenes where he's drawn what all the buildings looked like in the White City.
Well, maybe you could talk about how visual references encouraged this linguistic part of you.
Oh, yeah. That's always been something that's interesting to me. I teach writing, and Zabold is one of my favorite authors to talk about because he links that idea of image and does text illustrate image or does image illustrate text. He kind of pokes fun of that so wonderfully. And that was what was fun about writing this book, was that, you know, there are actual images. I could look at photos of Twain, I could look at photos of Tesla in the laboratory and try to imagine. Curiously, there are no, or at least I didn't find them, recordings of Tesla in film and he died in 43. You'd think there would be.
He was a recluse, though.
Or his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, but here's the inventor radio, and we don't have his voice recorded at all.
Yeah.
It seemed pretty curious.
Yeah, very ironic.
And so, all that I did have were photographic images.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the notion of doctors and inventors and scientists coming here from across the Atlantic, and then working working-class jobs or digging ditches and the like. This seemed to me a really fascinating component of Tesla's life and also this particular book. This idea of, well, you know, the land of opportunity is really a matter of becoming a serf. So yeah. I wanted to ask you about
that. Yeah, when I was teaching at Pace, I had a student who she was Albanian and she'd been a surgeon in Albania. She was working $7 an hour job as a cashier in the casino in Atlantic City. And as soon as she told me that story, I immediately struck me as how common that is of the immigrant experience, that if you don't have, you know, your PhD here in America, that we're not going to use you. And that's something that probably cropped up around the same time as the death of these inventors. I mean, Tesla didn't even finish college. Nobody ever cared about that. And in fact, I read that in Edison's laboratory, if you had a college education, you were actually made fun of for having that. That meant you weren't smart enough to teach yourself how to become an inventor.
Whereas now autodidactics are discouraged in our contemporary society.
Yeah,
if you're an autodidactic, you're declared a wild-eyed loon again. You know?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
You have no qualifications. Yeah. Where's your resume? We can't hire you.
And never mind that if you do have the qualifications, sometimes you just don't have the know-how.
Yeah.
Well, Samantha, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Whoa.